This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is Sasha Lilly. Does God exist? Can God's existence be proved or disproved? If God does exist, why do bad things happen to so many people? And if God does not exist, why do so many people believe in God? What's going on here? Questions like these, writes Andrew Pessin, are as deep and important as they come. But who should we look to for answers? Andrew Pessin, a philosophy professor, has completed a project that's both enlightening and provocative. He's reviewed some of the best arguments made over time on the God question and presents those arguments in a new book entitled The God Question: What Famous Thinkers from Plato to Dawkins Have Said About the Divine. Andrew Pessin is chair of the philosophy department at Connecticut College. Several weeks ago, we only had time to present portions of an extended interview that C.S. Soong conducted with Andrew Pessin about his book, The God Question. Today, we present the full-length interview for the first time. C.S. began by asking Professor Pessin what he hoped to achieve with his book.
Well, lots of people structure their lives around God or their idea of God. Lots of large-scale movements undertake all sorts of very large-scale actions, including violent actions in the name of God. So the hope would be that if this idea is going to have such a motivating force in individuals and in societies' lives and practices, that at the very least one would hope it would be a clear idea and as well thought out an idea as possible.
So is it your understanding that the way thinkers of religion and thinkers about God have produced ideas about God and given attributes to God, is it your sense that that has made people's understanding of God crystal clear?
That's a really great question and a difficult question. One of the things I think I discovered as I was doing the research for this book, which of course is trying to look at sort of the most interesting, important, and sometimes very strange things that great thinkers have said about God from pretty much the beginning of Western philosophy right up until the last couple of years, is the discovery of how much of a disconnect there can be between what the thinkers, and by that I mean like the professional thinkers, the philosophers, are saying about God and what is available or what is said in sort of the general public. There can often be a great divide between those two. So the question of how much trickle down there might be or how much influence these great thinkers have had on sort of the everyday person is not an easy one to trace. One of my hopes in putting the book together, as I was discovering this, was to perhaps better inform the public discourse of what some of the great thinkers have had to say on this topic.
Let's go back 2.5 millennia to the ancient Greeks. Did they espouse what might be called a Western religion?
If by what you mean by Western religion, which is what most people mean, or is Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, then the answer would be no. The ancient Greeks were basically pagans. They were polytheists. They believed in the existence of many different sorts of deities, and they had very, very, very anthropomorphic conceptions of those. So their deities were very much like human beings and engaged in all sorts of the craziness that human beings are engaged in. So the ancient Greeks, from a religious perspective, are not usually grouped in the Western traditions because most people mean by that the great monotheism. But I thought it important for a couple of reasons to include a look at the two most famous and important ancient Greek thinkers, Plato and Aristotle, of course, to look at what they had to say, because what they say about things divine absolutely sort of sets the table for what later thinkers say about the monotheism that they were working with in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So although they are not proponents of what we would call the Western religions, they sort of set the table for the thinkers of the Western religion, so that's why it's important to include them.
What did Plato have to say about how some things are transient and some things are eternal?
There's a good reason that Plato is usually called the father of Western philosophy, and the main reason is in the observation that an important distinction has to be made between the world as we experience it through the senses and the world as reason teaches us must be. And you've put your finger on it right there with that. The world experienced through the senses is very much constantly changing, constantly in flux, subjective in all sorts of ways. How you perceive the world might not be how I perceive it. Literally, how something tastes to you might not be how it tastes to me, and so forth. But he recognized that as you begin to think and reason about the world, you begin to recognize there's more to the world than that. There is another realm, which philosophers like to call the realm of either Platonic heaven sometimes, or just the realm of Plato's forms, with a capital F. And that world is populated by these eternal, unchanging entities or beings. And there's a tremendous amount to be said about what Plato means by that, but this also, I guess, reveals why it's important to begin the book with Plato, because he's the one who looks around in Western philosophy and says, there's more to the world than what we see with our eyes and smell with our noses and feel with our hands. There is this transcendental realm that's eternal and infinite and unchanging and ultimately responsible for the world. And of course, even if you can't call that God in any sort of Western religion sense, it's clearly a major step towards the basic idea of monotheism, that there is this infinite eternal being who is responsible for the world. So Plato really sets the stage very beautifully for the Western monotheisms.
We've heard a lot about eternal forms, Plato's forms. So, for example, the form of a horse, or the horse form, would be the ideal of a horse, and real horses are modeled after the form of a horse. Is Plato saying that the actual forms are divinity?
Whether Plato himself goes quite as far as that, I wouldn't say. I don't think that he does go as far as that. What happens, though, really within a few centuries of Plato? Plato was roughly the 4th century, before the Common Era, BC. And Christianity comes along 4 centuries later, and then the great Christian father and philosopher, St. Augustine, comes along a few centuries after that. So there's about 6 or 7 centuries from Plato to Augustine. And by the time you get to Augustine, he's very familiar with Plato. He's very influenced by Plato's ideas, specifically Plato's ideas of the forms. And he sees that as actually a problem for Christianity. If Plato is right that these eternal forms exist, then it seems there's something that exists that's eternal, that's completely independent of God. It's something that God didn't create, according to Plato. It's something that's as eternal as God and might even seem to compete with God for sort of the status of most fundamental being. So Augustine realizes he has to somehow incorporate these Platonic forms into the Christian picture of things, and that is one of his great contributions to philosophical theology, we might say. He, to put it in a nutshell, thinks of Plato's forms, he basically describes them as ideas in God's mind. So, of course, they're eternal, because they're in God's mind, and God is eternal, and God's mind is eternal, and they are co-eternal with God in the sense that both God and these forms have always been, necessarily always will be, but by the same token, they're in God, and in that sense, dependent on God. So he takes the forms, which Plato himself wouldn't identify with God in any recognizable sense, I believe, and he essentially makes them ideas in God's mind, so comes very close to identifying them with God.
There's also a very interesting debate between Augustine and Cicero, and it has to do with human free will. And maybe we could start with Cicero, who I believe lived in the 1st century BCE. If God is omniscient, one might suspect that God, if such a thing exists, knows what we, what humans, will do in the future. What did Cicero think of this?
I'm glad you brought up that particular problem. All the chapters in this book are quite short, and they're trying to each isolate one important, interesting, or, as I mentioned, often strange thing that a great thinker has said about God. But, of course, the conversations that these thinkers are having amongst themselves do stretch out over the centuries. So ideas brought up early on, as we were just talking about with Plato, get addressed and responded to and developed by later thinkers such as Augustine. There is perhaps no other theme, other than the one that you mentioned, which is so prominent throughout the entire history of philosophers thinking about God. And in particular, it's the theme of how to reconcile God's omniscience or foreknowledge with our freedom. So in the book, I basically give the problem. I have Cicero raise the problem in the 1st century BC, as you mentioned. But you can actually see hints of it even back in Aristotle. And in the book, there are about 5 or 6 different chapters of later philosophers all responding to the problem. So to set the table with Cicero, his argument was basically this. If God is to be omniscient or all-knowing, he must know the future, because the future is something to be known. If God knows in advance everything that's going to occur, and it's certain that these things would occur, since God would never make mistakes in his beliefs about the future, Cicero argues, nothing can be guaranteed to happen unless it is unavoidably caused to happen by something that went before it. So if an event is guaranteed to happen, then a prior event is guaranteed to happen which causes it. But then that prior event itself must have an even earlier event which causes it, and so on. And before you know it, every single event that occurs is such that it is unavoidably caused to occur. And if it's unavoidably caused to occur, Cicero concludes, it's essentially predetermined, unavoidable, as I mentioned. Everything is governed by fate, and all sorts of bad things ensue from that conclusion. So he reasons, if God is omniscient and knows the future, then all these bad consequences ensue. He felt that those bad consequences were intolerable. They amount to depriving us of our free will. If everything we do is predetermined and fated, then it's not up to us, he worries. The way to avoid that conclusion, give up the idea that God is omniscient or has foreknowledge. So that's the way Cicero sort of presents the problem for a number of subsequent philosophers to grapple with.
Yeah, you write that not granting God omniscience may admittedly diminish our conception of God to some degree, but such is the cost of freedom, of human freedom.
Right.
Okay, so then we get to Augustine many centuries later. What does he think about Cicero's conclusions on this topic?
Well, by the time you're at Augustine a few centuries later, Christianity is all the rage, so to speak, and he is this, you know, prominent Christian thinker at this point. So what he wants to do, just as we saw him doing with Plato, Plato's philosophy raised a problem. There are these eternal forms that seem independent of God. Augustine, the great early Christian thinker, had to reconcile that with important Christian beliefs, so he made those forms into ideas in God's mind. So too Cicero, who basically is a Roman pagan of the first century BCE, he's raised another problem. If we say God has foreknowledge, then we lose our human free will. Well, we can't give up free will, therefore get rid of foreknowledge. So Augustine has to reconcile or deal with this argument to sort of defend really two fundamental principles of Christianity, which are both that God has foreknowledge and that human beings have free will. Augustine is not willing to give up either of those. So he has to find a way to defuse Cicero's project, or argument rather, in order to preserve both divine foreknowledge and human free will. And the way he does it is very interesting. He essentially grants a crucial part of Cicero's argument. He agrees that if God knows the future, then everything that's going to happen is caused to happen by something prior to it, you know, all the way back down to the ancient past. So everything is, in fact, predetermined. He grants that. But what he denies instead is that that somehow takes away our free will. The way he basically makes the point is by asking, what do we mean exactly when we say that we do something freely? And his answer is, well, it means that we do it because we want to, and if we didn't want to, we wouldn't do it. And that's a pretty reasonable definition of free will, just, you know, out of context, right? So if that's what it is to act freely, he says, that's perfectly consistent with Cicero's predeterminism. Because as you ask, for example, why did you put on your red shirt this morning? The answer will be because I wanted to. Why did you want to put on the red shirt? And then there'll be some other answer before that, because I was feeling adventurous today, and that caused me to choose an adventurous color or something. Everything is caused, including our wants and our actions. But as long as, Augustine says, we do our actions because we want to and wouldn't have done them if we hadn't wanted to, then we do them freely. So everything can be predetermined, including our wants, our desires, our volitions, to use a kind of fancy philosophy term. But Augustine says that won't take away our freedom, because freedom is doing what we want, even if our wants are somehow predetermined. So that's a sort of famous first answer to how to reconcile free will and God's foreknowledge. Admit that everything's predetermined, but argue that free will is comfortable with everything being predetermined.
Andrew Pessin joins us on Against the Grain on KPFA. He is a philosophy professor at Connecticut College, and he's author of The God Question, What Famous Thinkers from Plato to Dawkins Have Said About the Divine, published by One World. You have a portion of this book devoted to the Middle Ages and some of the thinkers during the Middle Ages. And one key event was the rediscovery of Aristotle's works, I believe, in the 12th century. What, basically, were Aristotle's thoughts about divinity? And how important were Aristotle's ideas to the conceptions of God that developed in the Middle Ages?
That's a terrific question. So Aristotle, the great Greek pagan, he was extremely influential in his day, but then for various historical reasons, I think having to do with the burning of the library at Alexandria, a lot of his works were essentially lost to the first millennium of the development of Christianity and Christian thinking. Plato's works were largely preserved, so Plato was the very popular ancient Greek philosopher through much of the first 1,000 years of Christianity, and there was only a scattered work or two of Aristotle that was available to the Christian thinkers. But then, as you mentioned, around the 12th century, some copies of Aristotelian manuscripts, which had been preserved by very indirect means, started making their way to the Western thinkers, to the Christian thinkers, and at this point, Christianity, of course, by the 12th century, dominates Europe. And when these manuscripts were first discovered, the first readings of them were, in fact, quite shocking to the Christian thinkers. There were a number of Aristotelian doctrines that seemed to contradict fundamental tenets of Christianity, including the idea of a God who is a person who acts freely in creating the world at a certain moment. Aristotle's God seems to be a being that sort of acts necessarily and impersonally, and indeed Aristotle basically held that the cosmos had always existed eternally, co-eternally with this divinity, and all of these were in violation of basic Christian ideas that God is a free being who freely creates the world at a time prior to which there was no world. So Aristotle is a terrific challenge for Christianity. He doesn't merely hold these doctrines, but he's also clearly very smart and makes very powerful arguments. So the first move, of course, not surprisingly, was to ban his works. The Christian authorities basically condemned Aristotle's works and forbade anyone from reading them. And we all know what happens when you do that. Everyone, you know, is reading them by candlelight under their covers because they become very exciting. And the more people started reading them, the more you couldn't help but be impressed by how smart Aristotle is and how persuasive his arguments are. So it became clear in really very short order. It's something like 50 years between Aristotle's works being condemned and the recognition that a new strategy was necessary from the Christian thinkers, namely not to forbid reading Aristotle, but somehow to embrace him. Just as Augustine had found ways of reconciling Plato's doctrines with Christianity, it was desired that ways be found of reconciling Aristotle's arguments with Christianity. And there, of course, there's no more important figure than Thomas Aquinas, the great Catholic theologian. Much of his philosophical work is devoted to precisely that, trying to show how, for example, Aristotle's unmoved mover could be identified with the Christian God. And once he did that, a very surprising result ensued, namely that within a matter of years, Aristotle went from being condemned and forbidden by the Christian authorities to essentially becoming required reading at all the universities. And within decades, major Christian doctrines were formulated in Aristotelian terms. So they didn't merely accept and reconcile him. Christian thinking actually began to reflect Aristotelian thinking in very sort of deep and fundamental ways. So it's a really fascinating episode in intellectual history, how a doctrine or a set of ideas or a philosopher can go from, you know, being treated one extreme to being treated at the opposite extreme. And this set in motion, when most people think of medieval philosophy, they're usually thinking of medieval Christian philosophy, which we can say lasts roughly from about the 12th century to about the 17th century, and that is really Christian Aristotelianism, that whole five-century period. So he ends up becoming absolutely essentially identified with Christian thinking by the time these great thinkers such as Aquinas are finished.
And there's a very famous argument for the existence of God put forward by Anselm, who lived in the 11th century. What did Anselm say was the relationship between a person having the idea of God in his or her mind and the actual existence of God?
Is perhaps the most famous single argument for the existence of God in the whole history of this business. There are many philosophical theologians who think that the whole project of proving God's existence is itself problematic, and just because you don't or can't come up with a good argument for God's existence, of course, doesn't mean God doesn't exist. But if you are going to see what reason can prove, this argument, this Anselmian argument, is one you're going to have to grapple with. What makes it so exciting to many philosophers is that it does something which is really unique amongst the different arguments for the existence of God. Most of the arguments for the existence of God that have been developed start from observations about the world around us. They look around, they see motion in the world, they see causation in the world, they see what looks to be a kind of intelligent design in the world, and they argue from those properties of the world to the conclusion that some God must exist who is responsible for motion, causation, design, etc. What makes Anselm's argument so unique is that it doesn't proceed that way at all. It rather proceeds, as you were beginning to sketch, from the very idea of God, the idea of God that one has in one's mind. You don't even need to know anything about the universe around you to prove God exists. You just have to have the idea of God in your mind, he claims. And what's, of course, so interesting is that even the atheist, whom Anselm refers to as the fool, so that gives you his perspective on this issue, even the atheist has the idea of God, because what the atheist is saying is God does not exist. But you can't say that unless you have the idea of God in your mind and you simply deny that any being corresponds to it. So Anselm's really crucial strategy is to say, as long as you have the idea of God in your mind, you must in fact affirm that God exists. Now, if you'd like me to go through it, I can. I do warn you, it gets it's a mouthful, this famous argument, but I'm happy to take a quick stab at presenting the argument if you'd like.
Let's try it.
Okay. So here's basically how the argument goes. We'll grant as a premise that even the atheist has the idea of God in his mind. And what is the idea of God? Well, Anselm says, here's a definition. Here's something which describes this idea. God is the being than which none greater can be conceived. So the being than which none greater can be conceived. For short, we're going to call that the greatest conceivable being. It's a little bit easier to say.
Okay.
And usually, if you want to have this argument, if you happen to be a theist and you want to try to entrap your atheist friends, the way you proceed is you say, here's a definition, here's the idea of God, the greatest conceivable being. Do you accept that definition? And, you know, 9 out of 10 atheists, if they're not being suspicious of you, will say, yeah, I'll accept the idea of God is the idea of the greatest conceivable being. And of course, as an atheist, I just deny that such a being exists. But what I'm granting is that that's what the idea of God is, the idea of the greatest conceivable being. But once you've granted that and some claims, you're really 98% of the way there. For if you think about this idea of the greatest conceivable being, and you imagine for a moment that this being only exists in your mind as an idea, and compare it and imagine what it would be if this being existed in reality outside of your mind, you would quickly realize, he thinks, that it's greater, or a being is greater if it exists outside of a mind than if it merely exists as an idea inside of a mind.
I agree with that.
Okay, then I won't defend that, because that usually needs a little bit of defense. So if you accept that, then you're 99% of the way there. So he says, if you deny that the greatest conceivable being exists outside your mind, it's not really the greatest conceivable being you're thinking of. For the greatest conceivable being that existed only in a mind would be less great than the greatest conceivable being existing outside of a mind. And therefore, the claim that the greatest conceivable being exists only in the mind amounts to saying the greatest conceivable being is not the greatest conceivable being, because it could be greater. That, of course, is a contradiction. To say the greatest conceivable being is not the greatest conceivable being. Therefore, the starting point which led to that contradiction, the assumption that this being exists only in the mind as an idea, must be false. Therefore, the being exists also in reality. So that's complicated. It's hard to do sort of, quickly on the phone, but that is the basic idea, to say once you grant this definition that God is the greatest conceivable being, you would contradict yourself if you denied this being existed in the world. And since contradictions are always false, according to almost every philosopher, then it must be that the greatest conceivable being exists not only in your mind, but also in reality.
There is much I could say about it, and no doubt there's much that you could say about this argument, but we'll let our listeners mull it over. And there is so much in this book, The God Question, by my guest Andrew Pessin, that I want to cover, that we will move forward in time and discuss other thinkers Andrew Pessin is a philosophy professor at Connecticut College. He is co-author of Gray Matters, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Mind, and author of The 60-Second Philosopher. We're talking about his book, The God Question, what famous thinkers from Plato to Dawkins have said about the divine. My name is C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on KPFA and kpfa.org.
And we'll take a short break and return with more of Andrew Pessin. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. Andrew Pessin is a philosophy professor at Connecticut College and the author of a number of books, including The 60-Second Philosopher and Gray Matters, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Mind. C.S. Song recently spoke to Andrew Pessin about his new book, The God Question, what famous thinkers from Plato to Dawkins have said about the divine. You can find a link to that book and to Professor Pessin's blog at againstthegrain.org, where you can also find on-demand and downloadable audio. Let's return now to that interview.
Another recurring theme in this book is how thinkers who do believe in God deal with the question of evil, with the fact that atrocities happen every day and people suffer enormously in this world that isn't fair to many people. And Nicolas Malebranche was born in Paris in 1683. I know you've been interested in this thinker for quite some time. What did he do with the argument that the existence of wickedness in this world is good grounds for doubting the existence of a perfectly good God?
Yeah, that's obviously a terrific question, and it continues to be a timely question. In the history of philosophers thinking about this business, those who are inclined towards atheism usually spend their time criticizing the theist argument. So the believers will make all sorts of arguments for the existence of God, and most atheists spend their time just poking holes in those arguments. The problem of evil is sort of the one major place where atheists will go on the offensive, and they'll say, it's not just that I'm disproving your argument for the existence of God, but I am going to outright disprove the existence of God directly. And the way they do it, just to put it very briefly, is to say, this God of these major Western religions is supposed to be omnipotent, omniscient, and perfectly good. He's all-powerful, all-knowing, and perfectly good, and moral, and just, and benevolent, and all those good things. Such a being would never create a world with evil in it, or with so much evil in it. Therefore, the fact that there's evil in the world, or so much of it, proves there is no such being. So that's the basic problem of evil, as it's usually called. And from early on, philosophical theologians have been interested in addressing it. That project really took an important new leap as you got into the 17th century for a number of reasons, but most importantly, we have this philosopher Nicolas Malebranche, who was the most important philosopher in France after Descartes, both chronologically in the 17th century and in terms of influence. He was widely recognized to be one of the great thinkers of his time across Europe, and interestingly, today he's barely heard of in the English-speaking world, certainly by anyone other than professional philosophers, yet he's really an important thinker and a very interesting and unusual thinker. So one of his interesting ideas was directed towards this problem of evil, and he was influenced by the science of his time. So this is why his new strategy is so important. As you're getting into the 17th century, you see the rise of modern physics through the works of people like Galileo and Descartes and Newton and others, and the picture of the world that is being developed by the contemporary scientists of that century is very much one of a mechanical nature. The world is like a complicated machine, or maybe I shouldn't say complicated, actually, a relatively simple machine that consists of just matter moving according to a few very simple laws of motion, a few simple laws of physics. And it was believed quite optimistically that almost every phenomenon within science could ultimately be explained in terms of matter moving according to just a few simple laws of motion. So as the science became very prominent and spread very quickly in the 17th and 18th centuries, Malebranche adopted this basic idea as a kind of new way for a believer to respond to the problem of evil. And so here's how he goes, in brief. He says, if you start with the idea of God, so we're back to this idea of God, and ask yourself what sort of world such a being would create, you might get a sort of interesting answer. God is supposed to be omnipotent and infinitely intelligent and wise and all that stuff. And so what he would create would be basically the best possible world that could be created. But because he's so, how should we put this, so talented, so skillful, he is the master craftsman. No craftsman compares. The clearest distinction between a good craftsperson and a poor craftsperson is that the good craftsperson can accomplish by very simple means what the less talented craftsperson does sort of in an ad hoc manner. So if you were to look at whenever I build something, you know, I start off with a certain plan and then I screw up and then I have to change my mind to fix the screw up, and by the time I'm done, there's a bunch of mistakes, if I ever finish at all. But a master craft person anticipates everything in advance, never has to change his plan, and executes everything flawlessly by the simplest means possible. So says Malebranche. Well, that's how God would create the world. He would therefore create the world to be governed by the simplest laws of motion possible, which of course happened to obtain according to Malebranche's conception of science. And then he would never intervene in that world once he set into motion, because to intervene in the world is to change your mind about what is to occur. You already had it all planned out in advance. To change your mind, it would be anathema to God. So of course he would start the world, make it follow the laws of motion, and then never intervene again unless unbelievably extraordinary circumstances should obtain. Well, how does that solve the problem of evil? The answer, according to Malebranche, is that what God wants to create is the best possible overall world from its beginning in creation to whenever it ends in annihilation and destruction, whatever point that will be in the future. Since God is going to follow the laws of nature as he creates this world, along the way, certain evils are going to be generated by the laws of nature, but since the overall goal is the best possible world from beginning to end, God will tolerate and permit those evils because they are part of what's necessary to create the best possible world via laws of nature. And that's why there's evils in the world, or at least natural evils in the world. They are generated by the laws of nature, which overall are producing the best possible world in the long run. So that's how Malebranche uses the science of his day to this, you know, important philosophical end of explaining how the existence of God is at least compatible with the existence of many of the evils in the world.
In your book, The God Question goes into how Leibniz expanded on and supplemented Malebranche's ideas, and how people like Voltaire tried to rip it apart, basically tried to critique it and say, well, this makes no sense at all. There is nothing necessary for an omnipotent God. And if God were omnipotent, then God could intervene to prevent people from experiencing evil and malice. I do, however, given the time, I want to go forward to G.W.F. Hegel and his idea of God in relation to human history. How did Hegel link the idea of God with how human history had progressed?
If you had to choose one of the approximately 60 philosophers whose views are represented in the book as earning the title of the most obscure and difficult philosopher, it would probably be Hegel. So I won't even try. I don't even have the expertise to give the best possible answer here in the shortest amount of time. But roughly, Hegel, to put it just in a couple of sentences to get at least the flavor of his position, he thinks of human beings, the consciousness of human beings, as God's way of thinking about himself. God is fundamentally a process of self-reflection, but what's crucial to that process is that God creates consciousnesses, minds, / spirits, who are capable of reflecting on God, and that's how God ultimately maximizes his own reality by being thought of by human beings. And if you have this, I think it's a beautiful idea. It's very hard to sort of make sense of it and work it out in any literal way. But if you have this idea in mind that human consciousness is God's way of thinking about himself, then when you look at sort of the entire course of human history and you see how human beings' belief systems have changed over time from primitive times to what were really practically the ultimate times for Hegel, namely 19th century Germany, he thinks you can see a really almost linear progression of human beings getting a clearer and better and deeper and richer conception of God, and therefore of God, if what God is or rather if human beings are God's way of thinking about himself, the course of history is sort of God more explicitly realizing himself as human beings come to think about him more clearly, carefully, and explicitly. So Hegel sees the entire course of human history as almost as God's autobiography. It's God coming to be himself as human beings come to contemplate God in the right way. So that's a strange idea, and it's not one that's easy to elaborate on unless one is really a genuine Hegel scholar, but it's also a very beautiful idea, I think.
And Ludwig Feuerbach was one of Hegel's students. He said a lot of things about religion, but I want to focus on one thing he wrote, which is that religion has alienated us from ourselves. How so?
What's so fascinating about the 19th century, starting with Hegel and onwards, is you see this real explosion in thinking about God, and it's pretty much a negative explosion. It's become publicly acceptable in the course of the Enlightenment to become an atheist and become criticizing theology for the first time, and you see this public acceptance really just take off in the 19th century. So it's not just criticisms of arguments of the existence of God, but you begin to see sort of downright attacks on religious thinking as you get into the 19th century. And one of the first modes of that attack is through this guy named Feuerbach, who is one of Hegel's followers, as you mentioned. And in his view, Hegel essentially gets things backwards. Hegel thinks of human beings as God's way of thinking about himself. But what Feuerbach wants to say is really God is human beings' ways of thinking about themselves, so sort of reversing the order of thought there. And to put that in a very simple way, he basically thinks human beings create the idea of God. They create it not out of nothing in the way that God allegedly created the cosmos. They create it out of their own idea of themselves. So human beings take everything that we think is good in us, like power and love, and then we project it onto this being, and then we make it infinite in him. So we have some power. We think power is good. God will be infinitely power. We admire love. We think love is a wonderful thing to do, so we make God infinitely loving and so forth. All that would be sort of well and good, I suppose, for Feuerbach, except that after we then create this being out of ourselves, we then sort of bow down and begin worshiping it, and we create power structures which ultimately subject us in various ways on the basis of this being. And that's fundamentally what he means by alienation. To alienate is to be made other. And so for Feuerbach, human beings create this idea of God, don't recognize that the idea comes from ourselves, and then we put ourselves beneath God and make ourselves subject to God, and that's what it is to alienate ourselves from ourselves. We are treating as other this idea of God, something which really comes from ourselves. So that's really the beginning of a certain style of critiquing religious belief by looking at, in effect, what are almost the psychological sources of religious belief? Where does religious belief come from? Feuerbach asks. It comes from human beings projecting, you know, images of themselves onto this other being. And once you open that mode of inquiry, you sort of set the stage for some of the thinkers to follow, and it becomes sort of a major intellectual project in the 19th and 20th century to not evaluate what's a good argument for the existence of God, what's a bad argument, but rather ask, well, you know, what are the psychological processes or other processes by which human beings even come to believe in God in the first place? So you have these almost scientific approaches to why people believe, as opposed to philosophical arguments about what are good reasons to believe.
Well, what about the brilliant German thinker Friedrich Nietzsche? From where did Nietzsche think the idea of God came from?
You know, Nietzsche is crazy. but I mean that as a compliment when applied to a philosopher. Although he was literally crazy, he spent the last 10 years of his life in an asylum, probably with syphilis-induced insanity. So he was pretty crazy. But that, of course, doesn't mean that his works aren't... And his works reflect the craziness in terms of this incredible passion. And they can be very disjointed and filled with exclamation marks. But even if he is a little crazy, or a lot, that doesn't mean there aren't some very profound, you know, truths in the things that he utters. So according to him, he has a very famous work called On the Genealogy of Morals, where he's asking, where did our contemporary moral systems ultimately come from? And according to him, to give you the short version, a long, long time ago, ancient peoples realized, for example, that power is a good thing, and those who were powerful were entitled to rule, and you always were subject to powerful people, and you admired powerful people. Power was a good thing. But basically, when Christianity came along, according to Nietzsche, Christianity inverted the fundamental values. Christianity, or the Christian priests, way back when, according to Nietzsche, out of a feeling of resentment, out of a feeling of being powerless, decided to invert values. And rather than praise power as being sort of a good thing and the ultimate thing to strive for, Christian priests, out of a spirit of resentment of people who were more powerful, began to develop a worldview where actually weakness was good. And, you know, you have the famous biblical quote, the meek shall inherit the earth. That's a crucial Christian quote, according to Nietzsche, because it's making meekness be a good thing instead of power be a good thing. And it's getting everything backwards, according to Nietzsche. And, of course, what's fascinating, the subsequent history of Christianity, once you make this inversion and start praising the weak, the meek, and the sick, instead of the powerful, the virile, and the strong, Christianity itself becomes incredibly powerful. So, according to Nietzsche, this Christian morality, the official doctrine that somehow meekness and weakness and poverty are to be praised, he thinks of as born out of a spirit of resentment and something that needs to ultimately be overcome. So, of all the critiquers of Christianity, his is probably the most virulent sort of attack. He really thinks, this is a famous line of his, it really should be attacked with a hammer, just be destroyed.
I'm C.S. He is Andrew Pessin, P as in Paul, E-S-S-I-N. He is chair of the philosophy department at Connecticut College. We're talking about his book, The God Question, published by One World. The subtitle is What Famous Thinkers from Plato to Dawkins Have Said About the Divine. And really, there is so much in this book, and it's really only possible to scratch the surface of it, even in an extended interview like we are having today. I want to get to a couple thinkers who've presented what I think to be very compelling, I won't say arguments for the existence of God, but arguments about the relationship of humans to a divinity, if such a divinity exists. The Danish thinker Søren Kierkegaard certainly comes to mind, and he put forward what many found to be a compelling notion of the individual person's relationship with God. Tell us about this.
Kierkegaard is a late 19th century Danish thinker, as you mentioned, and often considered one of the founders of the school known as existentialism, which is a school that many people will have heard of. What's probably most interesting about Kierkegaard, at least for our purposes or for my purposes, is his belief that the philosophical attempt to sort of logically analyze God, which is what governs the philosophical theology tradition for many centuries prior to him, is deeply and fundamentally misguided. For him, ultimately, the religious existence is one of a subjective passion that in the deepest of ways transcends logic and reason. And for him, the best way to get at that is to recognize that at the heart of Christianity, and he was, of course, a Christian thinker, at the heart of Christianity is this fundamental contradiction, this fundamental absurdity, the most fundamental one being that God somehow becomes man, human being in the form of Jesus Christ, and is somehow simultaneously divine and not divine, or, you know, human being and not human being. And he says that it's only when you sort of take this leap of faith into the absurd, and what's contradictory is absurd, it's something you can't possibly understand in an intelligible way, that you ultimately can achieve sort of the proper and appropriate religious experience. That sort of experience, unlike all this philosophical theology, which has preceded it by centuries, is very personal and subjective. It's something each individual has to do for himself, not just once, but he sees it as, crucially, as a repetition. Every moment of every day, you have to be embracing the absurd in order to have the proper religious experience. Philosophical theology, which is a matter of logically analyzing propositions, as we've been exploring a little bit in this conversation, that's something that's, you know, accessible to everyone. I can utter a proposition, you can raise an objection, I can make an argument, and it's a sort of public thing that we can all do together. But this experience of embracing the absurd is as private and personal as dying is for an individual. I mean, 10 people might unfortunately pass away at the same time in an explosion or something like that, but each person's dying is individual and unique to that person alone. And Kierkegaard thinks that religious life and religious experience is as personal and individual as that, and therefore not really subject to sort of philosophical analysis.
Does he say we need to dispense with reason, with rationality?
What he seems to recognize is that either the typical way to go, or maybe it's even the advisable way to go, I'm not sure, the preferential way to go, is through certain stages. So assuming it's the advisable way to go, rationality is an important stage of this development. He thinks that people typically will go through three stages, what he calls an aesthetic stage, where we're very immersed in our senses and our sensory experiences, and then an ethical stage, where we are very interested in rationality and reason and in ethical norms, which he thinks are products of sort of objective reasoning. But then the crucial move is to transcend that and take this leap of faith. So it's not that one dispenses with reason or philosophical analysis altogether. It's that one does dispense with it at the appropriate stage, but the philosophical reasoning might be a necessary step in that process.
Martin Buber was born in 1878, died in 1965. How important was it to Buber that individuals form a personal, direct relationship to God?
That's a terrific question. If there's one theme among several, as you get into the 20th century of philosophers thinking about God, you see this increasing resistance to the idea that God can be captured in philosophical thought, that logic and reasoning and analysis are the proper or the best way to really grapple with God. So we're just talking about Kierkegaard, who's sort of an important step in that, and Buber, a few decades later, essentially follows that tradition. So Buber distinguishes two different sorts of relationships a person can have. He calls one the I-you, as in Y-O-U, and the other one is the I-it, I-T. And basically, when you take an I-it attitude or relationship to something, you're treating it as an object for your purposes and for your uses, and you're not sort of genuinely engaging with whatever it might be in its own right. But when you have a genuinely personal relationship, an I-you, Y-O-U, relationship, typically with another human being, then you are engaging with them in their essence. And that's, of course, the appropriate relationship, kind of relationship to have with another person. We don't use people as objects for our own means. And according to him, God is not something that is properly captured in philosophical analysis, just as Kierkegaard said. To treat God as an idea that you reason and do logic with is to treat it as a kind of object and not to treat God as a kind of person with whom you have a relationship. If you want to have any sort of model for the personal relationship one should have with God, what you need to do is look at the personal relationships you have with other human beings, because that's when you experience personal relationship, I-U, Y-O-U, relation. So he has this very beautiful idea that somehow the personal relationship we have with God is manifest in the personal relationships we have with other human beings. And so every time you are genuinely engaging with another, treating them with respect as an individual with rights and interests of their own, you are actually getting a little glimpse of what it's like to have a relationship with God. So the relationship with God is literally found in the relationships we have with other people.
Would Buber say that God exists out there?
I don't know. That's a great... if our relationships with other people exist out there, then, and our relationship with God is manifest in that, then yes. But I think you mean something a little more strongly, like even if you stop hanging out with other people, would God still exist? And I don't know the answer to that question for Buber, so that's a terrific question.
A lot of wonderful questions are presented and discussed in this book, The God Question. And let's end with this question, which is that you write that a new breed of theism has arisen in recent decades. How does this new breed differ from older strands of theism?
What I would say about the new breed is, maybe I should say new breeds, because what's happened as you're in the 20th and 21st century is that the conversation about God sort of fractures into many distinct conversations. Throughout the whole medieval period, even through the modern period of 17th, 18th century thinking, you get the strong sense that there's sort of one major tradition, it's primarily the Christian tradition, and everyone's discussing aspects of it, and there's plenty of disagreement, and people have their own versions of their own theories, but you get the sense that there's kind of one big conversation going on. As you get into the 20th and 21st centuries, that dissipates. You get the sense that there's many different ways of thinking about God now. There's many different perspectives. Much of the classical tradition, where God is seen as kind of like a person with key attributes such as omnipotence and omniscience and goodness and eternality and immutability and simplicity and a bunch of others your listeners probably would never have thought of, all of that is now seen as being up for grabs. So you have people developing ideas of God, but sort of dispensing with the omnipotence, or dispensing with the omniscience, or dispensing with the eternality. God, and to many thinkers in the 20th century, is a very temporal being who's actively engaged in everyday events, as opposed to being the kind of eternal, removed, unchanging being. So the conversation fractures, and you get the classical attributes, you find more and more thinkers willing to give up some of the classical attributes of God, such as omnipotence, omniscience, and so forth. So it keeps on going, this conversation, but it really starts taking lots and lots of different directions.
Andrew Pessin, chair of the philosophy department at Connecticut College. We've been talking about his book, The God Question, what famous thinkers from Plato to Dawkins have said about the divine, published by One World. Thank you so much, Andrew, for writing this book and for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, C.S., for having me. It was a great pleasure.
And I'm Sasha Lilly, and on tomorrow's Against the Grain, I'll talk with South Africa-based scholar Patrick Bond about the upcoming climate change conference in Copenhagen, which activists are likening to the meeting of the WTO in Seattle 10 years ago. That's tomorrow on Against the Grain, beginning at noon. And please visit us on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, submit comments, and find ways to reach us. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670.